Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial.
Well, hello and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. Welcome aboard. Welcome, welcome. It is, what are we up to? Episode number 127. And it's September. It's towards the end of September. We have two great guests lined up, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time in the beginning talking about all sorts of things. You know what's going on with the markets. We're seeing a little bit of choppiness, but pretty much on the way up. A little bit down, a little bit up on the intraday, but if you look at just the afterday, it's just pretty much been a straight ride up, and that's been a lot of fun. We see a lot of concern over some trade issues with China, and that has China all over the place, particularly Shanghai, not so much Hong Kong, but the Shanghai Shenzhen market has been down and up and down and up all over the place. We're seeing oil peak again. We're seeing natural gas. Did you see natural gas last week? Oh, my. I mean, we're talking about, I don't know, a 30 to 40% move in the last 10 days or so with natural gas, and that's quite remarkable, especially when we saw, you know, multi-year lows. We saw commodities, we saw corn move up dramatically. We're going to talk about that with our first guest, who is going to be, I think, very interesting to you. His name is Larry Williams, and then we're going to talk about some technical analysis. Who I brought on the guru of this, who's Corey Rosenboom from Afraid to Trade. .com, and we're going to talk about some of these things because I think that it's an interesting inflection point here to step back for a second and see what's going on around the world and with markets on a technical basis as well as with commodities, because we're seeing some interesting movement of late. We're seeing the markets react in a very interesting manner, I think. Hope things are well with you, and I hope that your portfolios are doing well and that you're getting a lot out of the opportunity to be disciplined and be a disciplined investor. And I think I mentioned this to you last week or the week before maybe, but if you haven't, some of the terminology you want to know a little bit more about, you want to understand a little bit about what's a PE ratio or how do you short a stock, check out the Winning Investor Podcast. That's something I do for the Quick and Dirty Tips Network, and I think you'll very much enjoy it. And I mentioned last week also, if you want to follow me because you want to find out, you know, when's the podcast coming out, well, you can go right to Twitter. That's Andrew Horowitz at Twitter. Just type in my name, one full word, no spaces, Andrew Horowitz, and check that out. And lastly, we'll just leave it on the fact that if you want to see that 14-minute tour of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, it's a virtual audio-video tour. Just click on it. We'll put it on the show notes right on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We're not going to talk much more today because we're going to get right into our discussion with Larry Williams. When we get back, I'm just going to a quick musical interlude, and then we'll be right back with Larry Williams, who is a commodities and future trader. Stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. What I thought I'd do today is change it up a little bit, as I had always tried to do. We have Larry Williams with us today. He's been trading commodities and futures for, wow, long time, about 46 years, and he teaches it, and he writes about it, and he lives it and breathes it. And Larry Williams, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about trading. Just kind of like get us wet with the idea of what's happening in your world in terms of trading futures and commodity futures, et cetera.
Well, you know, it's the same old, same old. It's full of change.
Yeah.
We had such massive changes going from pit sessions to electronic sessions. And it's certainly been one of the biggest changes in my trading life. And you have to have adapted for it.
So, I mean, we're talking about from the kind of New York Stock Exchange to the NASDAQ concept.
Well, yeah, that's a good analogy, actually. I mean, I do some stuff in stocks and for a fund that I run that's pretty fundamental base. My active trading is in futures, and there we've gone from the old pit sessions where I knew guys on the floor, I had my brokers clearing for me on the floor, to now I'm placing the orders myself electronically on a platform. It means you have to learn the platform, you have to learn new trading strategies, you have to learn those new markets. 20 years ago, we couldn't trade the items we trade today.
Yeah, but what do you do? You got to forget all those hand signals now.
Yeah, no more hand signals.
Right?
You have to learn these stupid computers. And for a 67-year-old guy, that's a major trade.
Yeah, I hear
than
you.
To learn computers sometimes.
So what is your favorite trading? I mean, do you like to deal with the agricultural type of plays, you know, the corns, the soybeans, the things of that nature? Do you like to be more in the equity markets, bond markets, Forex? What is your forte?
I like them all.
Anyway, I can make money.
But my strategy is this. I want to find a market that I think is conditional, that's set up for an up move or a down move. Then I'll trade that market. So I first look for a condition. It might be grains. Like right now, I think soybean meal is getting ready for a rally. And I'm long bonds this week based on a setup condition. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was short crude oil. So I'm more interested in finding a condition, a market that's ripe, as opposed to, say, always trading gold.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, you're dealing with fundamentals? Probably not, because we're talking about fundamentals are much more
longer term. No, I do fundamentals. No. Very fundamentally driven, which always surprises people. They think, like, I'm a chart guy or something.
Yeah.
And I am throwing entries for timing my trades.
Right.
But the great difference between stocks and commodities, people really need commodities. They really need gold and wheat and soybeans. You don't really need a share of Microsoft. You can get along the rest of your life without it.
Yeah.
So there are conditions. There's real supply and demand for commodities. Now, how do you analyze the problem?
Mm-hmm.
And the big tool I use is the Commitment to Trader report that the government issues once a week that shows what the commercial interests, the producers, and the users of the commodity are buying or selling. And that's been the backbone of what I've done since 1970.
So is that and basically, you know, you'll look at that and find out where, I guess we'll say, demand is, and you know, or lack of demand for that matter, and then see I guess the you know what the traders who are really, I guess, interested and follow the trend. I mean, is that sum it up?
Yeah, there's a little bit more to it than that. I first want to see where the big guys are buying. If I'm looking for an example of a buy in the market, and then I want to look at the trend a little bit, but these big guys can buy and set up bottoms too. So I like to look at things like cycles to see are we at a cyclical low. And then I do another really interesting thing. I have a fundamental valuation tool. I think you can value a commodity just like you can value a stock based on its PE, price sell ratio, whatever, big ratios. You can value a commodity as well. Relative to, well, an easy example, in the soybean complex, you could value soybeans versus wheat and corn. At what point is it attractive for a producer to switch, or a feedlot to switch from wheat to corn to beans or whatever? So you can actually value commodities as well, and I do a lot of that.
And how long would your trade be on for? I mean, I know it could be probably on for a minute, but I mean, you know, what it could be on for any length of time, but what kind of time frame are you looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hope it's not on for a minute. It means I'm wrong.
Well, of course. I'm saying, right, but it could be.
But a lot of traders, you know, would be in and out. I'm not a day trader. My ideal trade would be in a trade today and be out in maybe 15, 20 days. That would be a phenomenal trade for me.
Right. We call that swing trading. We call it swing trading.
I don't have the ability to hold on for months. Yeah. I don't have the ability to sit and grind through all this stuff. I do it occasionally, but usually 12, 15 days, I'm real happy camping with that.
So recently we saw, I think it was last week, and I kind of want to ask you about this because we saw corn prices, I think, get stopped out at the top end of a 9% move on a day. I think it was a historic move on any given day. And I thought there was some limitations on that, or at least I thought there was some limitations. Do you know what I'm talking about on the rise?
Well, there is a unique thing about commodities, they can only go up or down so much in a given day, and it's called lock limit. They can't go up any more or down than that. So that does happen in commodities where you don't really have that in stocks. So there can be a potential maximum range for the day.
Mm-hmm.
in commodities, and that has happened occasionally.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, people I don't think know this, actually China, the Shanghai market, has a 10% cap up or down on any given day per stock.
Yeah, and it's a little different there. You know, I've lectured in Shanghai. My son taught English at the University of Shanghai, and there you can't sell short stocks. So their stocks actually act a little differently than American stocks for short-term trading.
Right.
A little bit of a difference there as well.
Right. So, so recently there's been a lot of talk about additional oversight of, by the CFTC. We've actually had a few of the former CFTC folks on here, particularly last summer where we were ranting about oil being out of control. And then they recently, the one of the guys, Bart, what's his name? I forgot his last name. From the CFTC, the guy with the long white hair, blonde hair, or I guess it's white maybe, had talked about how, yes, last year there was a lot of speculation that was going on, but we really didn't release that. Do you think that the oil markets are still being moved around? Natural gas, which recently hit some, you know, 9-year low and then just popped back dramatically when Goldman Sachs recommended it earlier in the week. Are these still tough to trade for individuals because of potential, you know, getting squashed by the big boys, or is it, you know, kind of calm down from last summer a bit?
Well, first I would say that the more government you have, the less liberty you have, and as someone who believes in free markets, I think that it's actually less regulation that's going to help the markets, not more.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you have to have a watchdog there for people that cheat.
Yeah, right.
But last year when oil was running up, of course, was the fault of the speculators.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now when energy got pressed to the downside, why didn't the speculators get the benefit of saying, hey, they're the ones that push prices down? So government people like to blame anybody but themselves for the problem. So I really like a free marketplace, and the fact that some people lose and some people win, hey, that's the game, and if you can't stand that game, you shouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a conspiratorial person. I'm terribly paranoid, but not conspiratorial. That's a dichotomy,
right.
Isn't it?
Am I conspiratorial? Am I? I think I am. Everybody thinks I am. No, maybe I'm paranoid.
Yeah. You have to triangulate this
right.
Thing. But I don't think that it's a loser's lament when somebody loses. Oh, they came and got me. Well, I've been in this business almost 50 years, and I've known most everybody in the business. I have yet to find this group, they, out there. So traders, oh, I got burned. Well, you know, you weren't doing what you should have done. You weren't phased with the market. I much more think it's your own personal responsibility as opposed to some group that's out there. And whenever the government does step in, they tend to do the wrong thing, or the exchanges. The exchanges to reduce speculation increase margin,
mm-hmm.
which means you're going to have fewer players in the game. If mm-hmm. you increase the price for a New York Yankee ticket, guess what? Not as many people go to the game.
Right.
Same thing, they increase the margin when a market's running out. That's the stupidest thing you can do.
Right.
Because then you have less liquidity in the market, not more.
Right.
So, you know, I'm a free market guy.
I hear you. So let's talk a little bit about you know, how people can. Well, let me first say, I want to talk about how people can get involved if they're interested, because a lot of people, I think, view commodities and futures as kind of like an institutional play. ETFs have come out of late who have recently, you know, formulated portfolios like the USO for oil or UNG for natural gas, DBA for food commodities, and so on and so on. But those have not been working quite well. I don't know if you follow these because of the contango issue on many of them, and because of some other issues. Gold has a GLD. That one's more closely aligned to gold. But there's some concern from the CFTC about how these are operating. But aside from that, there's also Forex. And I know that you trade Forex. Tell me a little bit about the Forex markets. I mean, I think in the last year has been...
Let me start with what I think, well, yeah, let's do Forex, and I'll work backwards up. Forex is a scam in this sense, that there were brokers that were saying, there's no commission. You can trade here without paying a commission. Well, that's a total lie. There's no commission, but you're paying pips or a point spread to get into the market. It's usually $40 to $80 a contract.
Right.
I can trade the exact same thing on the Globex, on the ICE, and my commission is maybe $2 to $5. So how do these people get away with saying there's no commission? Now, as they said that, they then lulled the public in, and worse yet, they said, we'll give you 100 to 1 times margin.
Yeah.
I have a lot more respect for some guy selling crack cocaine on the street corner than somebody offering 100 to 1 times more.
Well, that's really that's your problem with two things. The free market that doesn't have regulation. That's back to the watchdog. That's exactly the point.
It's, free market. It's okay for that to happen, but you know what? They're going to blow out all the suckers after a while.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, where are you? But they did pander to the public, and that bothers me. There obviously is a place for some regulation. But you got to be intelligent to do this. And so that's my biggest comment. There is a legitimate Forex bank trading market. I have no problems with that. It's these guys who fraudulently misrepresent things that bother me immensely. And in terms of the ETFs versus the actual commodities, you know, I'm an old country boy from Montana. I'm just going to trade the actual commodities. I don't want to get off into some paper derivative of pork bellies.
Right.
I have enough trouble with pork bellies.
Yeah.
So I have always believed you should deal with the principal, not the agent.
Right, so you're one step closer and one step more accurate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if I'm out there trading something else, an option or whatever it is, you know, why don't I just trade the principal? Why don't I just have my stops in place in this market?
Right.
And that sidesteps just so much of that.
So
the other point you
I'm sorry, yeah, I was going to talk about, go ahead, sorry.
Let me touch on this, because you mentioned a lot of people do believe now that commodities are like, there's a long-only commodity fund idea. Buy commodities, they will go up in value, but they have a long-term positive drift like stocks.
Right.
And I'm here to say that's a wrong-headed view, because commodities historically cycle. They crash and burn, and they have major run-ups and major run-downs. There's no long-term drift. Wheat's lower now than it was 20 years ago or thereabouts. There, you have booms and busts in commodities. You don't have that as much in stocks. So this idea of a positive drift to commodities, I think, is wrong-headed. It's a boom-bust market. All commodities are, as opposed to stocks.
So, but let's get back to Forex for 1 second. There's been more volatility in the Forex markets, currency markets, in the last, I'll say, 1 year or so, you know, give or take, than probably people who even trade, you know, have traded for years currencies have ever seen. I mean, when was there where there was a 2% differential, 3% differential between one and another currency? I mean, did you see that before? I mean, under normal circumstances?
You know, we haven't had currencies trading like that for a long time, but as a trader, I say, hey, that's great.
Yeah.
Bring it on. I want volatility.
Right, right. I mean, but it's pretty wild.
I want swings in a market. Yeah, now, that's why the money management is so important, that you can't do 100 to 1 times margin.
Right.
You have to use your money management relative to the current market volatility. It doesn't matter if it's soybeans or if it's a Forex spread.
So when you teach people how to, and you've taught people how to trade commodities, whether it's any of the things we've mentioned, what's kind of like you probably have number one rule that's, you know, you have to embed. I know that we have a stock trader that I know very well and teach people how to day trade. And one of the number one rules is you do not hold overnight. End of sentence. And you have to repeat it and swear by it and live by it. But you may not have something as severe as that, but you know, what are some of the basic things and maybe the key things that you teach as a commodities trader?
Sure. Well, the first thing that I would teach is that trend is the basis of all profits. You have to have trend, and trend is a function of time.
Mm-hmm.
So the longer you can be in a trade, the more profit more trend you're going to have.
Right.
The key underlying success of it, though, the way my daughter took $10,000 to $110,000 in a real-time trading contest when she was 16, when she was filming Dawson Creek, was with money management. That money management, if you are not managing your money correctly, your chances of a blow-up are great. And if you manage it correctly, your chances of substantial victory, like when I took $10,000 to $1.1 million in a year, real trading, real time, to win the Robbins World Cup Trading Championship, I was trading okay that year, but it was a money management that was able to have the exponential gain.
You would trade, and let me just repeat this back to you, okay? First of all, you threw a lot at me. You said your 16-year-old daughter, who was filming Dawson's Creek, took $10,000 to $110,000, and then you had an okay trading year where you traded $10,000 to over $1 million, just an okay trading year. A lot thrown at me right there, okay? So I'm not sure what's more impressive of that list.
You know, the trading contests are well-documented, though. Everybody says I had two accounts. If I did, you know, I had...
I believe you. I'm not doubting it. I just said there's a lot of good stuff right there.
A lot of people do, because it's impossible. But that actually happened, and it's not unique. It's happened before, and I've done other things similar to that. But and my trading was okay, and it was 1987. But what allowed the exponential gain in the account was the money management. Clearly, at one point, the $10,000 went to $2.2 million, dropped down to $750,000, and by the end of the crash of 87, by the end of the year, I got it back to $1.1 million. Wild. It was margining way too much, too aggressive, my money management. What Michelle did, hers, she started with $10,000 and went to $110,000. But her money management was much more conservative than mine. She never risked more than about 10% of her account on any one trade at any time.
Interesting. There is definitely some opportunity to make money in the commodity world. We do know that. So, and you've written some books. I mean, your site is irealltrade.com, and that's Larry Williams. So getting back to the idea of commodity trading for a second, I just want to kind of step back for a second. Oil has been interesting, and I've been asking myself this question for a while right now. You know, usually there's a relationship between oil and the dollar. We know about that. But it seems to me that the stock market in the U.S., we'll start with that, oil and the dollar have this interesting relationship of late. And I was wondering what comes first. Is it that oil starts moving up and the dollar moves down, which isn't supposed to be the theory? The dollar moves and then oil, or maybe none of this really even matters, but it just seems kind of interesting, like the tail is wagging the dog of late.
Well, whatever the relationship is, it seems to vary.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's not fixed. I think there's a relationship between the dollar and crude oil, and the relationship between the S&P as well as gold. So these relationships, and I've seen them over the years, there was one we called the silver bellies, where silver seemed to have a relationship to bellies when bellies were active, and they all come and go, which is why I love what Charles Darwin said. He said that the survival doesn't go to the strongest or the smartest, it goes to the one who can adapt the quickest. And I think that's the success of trading. You have to figure out, what do I need to adapt to here? The relationship between the gold and crude oil is changing. Maybe I should look at gold oil, crude oil and heating oil.
Right.
So, but I'm more impressed with a long-term cycle of crude oil than I am these immediate relationships that can vary and are as ephemeral as a Hollywood starlet. These things do have definite cyclical patterns to them.
So, but oil has been around for how many years? Let's just say 100. Let's just say, I mean, you know, give or take 10 or 20. Do you think you could...
Well, I started active trading in 1983.
Well, yeah, we have that. But I'm saying oil itself has been, I mean, used for motors and automobiles, et cetera.
I worked in a refinery. You know, my dad worked in a refinery in 1943. So, I'm well versed in that.
So you have data worth 25 years. What was that, 25 years? 25 years. Mm-hmm. Going back on the cycles of that. Is that long enough to have a cycle to really pull information out?
Well, it's long enough, I think, to find the seasonal pattern, because there's logic to seasonal pattern. You know that wheat is harvested in the fall, and so there's a natural cycle to these markets based on the commercial usage, and time allows us to see that a little bit better, but clearly there's a commercial usage cycle to all markets, including crude oil, and that's just... Now, the problem is, does it work? Is it there every year? No, it's not there every year. But it's a pretty good roadmap for things to follow. Generally, we know when the highs and lows are most apt to appear in the crude oil market.
Yeah. And what about we'll finish up with this. What about the area of sugar, for example, that had hit a multi-year high of late? If you look at the chart on sugar, it went up dramatically over the last number of months. It's been climbing for a while, but it went up. India was supposedly having a drought, one of the largest consumers of sugar in the world, and they said that was going to be a big issue. And again, we saw soybeans. Wheat hit this rock bottom. There was discussion back to India again for a moment, that in India there are fields and there are parking lots that are just covered with tarps, and under the tarps are drying wheat because it's just the crop is so amazing and so robust this year. I mean, are these things that by the time you hear this information are too late to play, or is this information you even use, or is it more of the kind of, you're not going to deal with the news items only, you're going to deal with trends from what you say. But, where are we in that whole genre of the beans versus sugar versus wheat and corn, et cetera?
Well, first of all, let me touch on crude oil briefly. The seasonal high in crude oil comes about the last week of September. So people might want to make note of that.
Okay.
All the news stories about commodities, I found I don't listen to. I really don't pay attention to much of any news at all because I tend to get sucked into it. So, in terms of wheat on the ground in India, I don't know, one of my best friends is the largest trader there, and we talk a lot about markets, but we never really talk about that genre of news. Only too often, the news is bullish at the top and bearish at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm much more concerned about finding a trade that's set up where I can actually see from the commitment of trade reports they are buying now. That means a lot more to me than any newspaper headline, that there is a seasonal low now, usually in a market that is part of a setup for me. I better start paying attention to that market.
Right, exactly. I hear you. Well, listen, we'll let you go here. I'm going to put a link on the show notes, of course, at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On where you can get in touch with Larry Williams at ireallytrade.com. You can see all the things that he does and how he teaches and some of the things he writes about in his books and his track record from the years and all those good things. And I want to say that I really appreciate you coming aboard today, Larry. And we'll definitely...
Pleasure was mine. I hope I gave some information to your listeners.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an area we really haven't covered before too much. We had one other gentleman on talking about some of the, a very active trader also talking about mostly the agricultural some time ago. But this is an area I think that a lot of people are interested in, especially as they watch the trading go on, particularly of oil, natural gas, heating oil, and some of these other commodities. So I appreciate it. Larry Williams, you're an awesome guest.
Thanks very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Good luck and good trading.
Thanks. And now, it's time for, as we would call it, the technical break here, because, we've had him on before. He's a great writer. He writes for the blog Afraid to Trade. And his name is Corey Rosenblum. And I thought that we'd bring him on because they have we have seen some interesting, some interesting areas on the general markets. Corey and I talk quite often. We strategize together. And he is, I guess you would call him a bit of a guru in terms of technical analysis, that charting and all that. And knows a lot about Elliott Wave and a variety of other things that we're going to kind of pick his brain about today. My friend Corey, how are you?
Doing well, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, buddy. Hey, listen. So one of the things that you and I have talked about is this overhead resistance issue, and let's explain that and set this up for a second. Basically, we saw the S&P 500 as an example. We could talk about the NASDAQ or the Russell or whatever. But the S&P 500 index, which is a key barometer of markets, break through some key resistance levels, these overhead, like kind of a ceiling. And, when we did that about the 1040 number, then about 1060, I asked you, and I want you to tell me again, what is happening, what we call overhead resistance or the ceiling? Where is the next ceiling?
Sure. What we looked at really was a Fibonacci level, and that's kind of a complex term, but really, just know that that resistance level was about 1014 in the S&P. Mm-hmm. There was also the November of 2008. That was the 1007. Beyond that, looking backwards, we're looking at price highs. The October high was 1014 in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Those were expected levels. Those broke. And when the resistance breaks, normally people who have stops at that level or people that expect them to hold, when they did not hold, sometimes creates a momentum burst because the new, it's almost open air, I think is a good term to use for that. Once resistance is cleared, there's no further reason to put on sell orders. And people who are betting against that or betting resistance will hold, well, they're wrong.
Right.
So they take their stop losses. And that it's almost a strange maneuver that creates an upward burst just because of that.
Hmm. So, you have to question what came first, right? Was it the fact that there were buyers that were moving up or were there sellers that were just covering their shorts? I mean, you have maybe a combination of the two. But what's interesting about that is, what's causing this? Is the chart causing it? Or is it just the chart telling it? What came first in this, the chicken or the egg?
I think that the charts are almost impeding it, but it's not enough. Charts are not the reason prices move.
Mm-hmm.
It's people putting on positions, hedge funds, mutual funds, general public. It's supply and demand. And so charts are only one way to look at that equation from that perspective. People that I've spoken with were destroyed in 2008 as the market continued to fall.
Right.
Their mutual fund accounts, their retirement accounts were decimated. So they pulled out of the market in October, November, December, January, going into 2009. Well, they did so at the bottom, people that did that. And now that the market's recovered 50%, they're having the same mentality of, why did I just do this? How did I get out at the bottom and hear the market recover? So they're just almost blindly putting money back in, of a fear mentality. The same fear that got them out of the market then is propelling them back in the market now, saying, I have a fear of missing out.
Hmm.
It's running away without me. And so it's really, I think that's mainly what's destroying these technical levels, breaking through resistance, breaking divergences, all these typical things that would work in a normalized environment. You almost have a stampede effect or a herd effect.
Right.
Get me in at any cost.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because just last week there was a couple of days when we saw a lot of individual positions just almost gasp higher. You know, just like this incredible move with no news, maybe broke through some technicals potentially, but we're talking about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8% gains in a particular day. And I don't think, unless there is any significant news or there is something else going on maybe that we don't know about in terms of news, or maybe maybe they got a deal, a company got a deal, or maybe something significant is happening, that is really warranted. And what I mean by that is that it almost seemed strange that we saw so many stocks doing that in the mid part of last week. And I don't know if you noticed that, but that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm not much of an individual stock picker. I look more at the indices themselves, but I missed some of that movement. But gaps in a stock, that sort of underscores the point of urgency. Have to get in, any cost, does not matter. So that's a demand equation coming in. So that would tell me that we're either just, the fear is out there and just have to get in at these prices. And really, regardless of the charts, regardless of the fundamentals, or even whatever strategies they're using, it's just that fear is such a motivator.
Which is very similar to what happened in, let's say, 1999, that I remember, that, you know, we saw the internet stocks gapping up by 10, 20, 30 points a day, high percentage moves that just kept on rolling. And again, not predicting that anything's going to fall right now, but just, you know, talking about the similarity between the two is pretty astonishing. I don't know if you see the same thing.
Not too much. I think that's, I had a discussion previously with someone about that too. And it's strange that there are comparisons between the two, definitely. Straight up, almost vertical moves, any kind of resistance is almost, you know, destroyed instantly in the market.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is now we're technically, Bernanke has said, we're possibly out of the recession, but just for the moment, for the Bureau, we're still in that recession. And people are more bearish, it seems like. A lot of people I talk to are saying this rally cannot last, it's an unsustainable rally. It's almost more pessimistic now, as opposed to 1999, when optimism ran the street. Anybody that was pessimistic was, you know, mocked or laughed at, or those kind of things. So it's the price movements may be similar, but the underlying structure, the psychology, the mentality, diametrically opposed.
But the only thing is that we're seeing one of the highest levels of bullish sentiment right now that we've seen since pre-Lehman. A lot of pre-Lehman discussion and comparisons are being made. And we're also seeing the record since 1983, we're seeing the 200-day moving average. So in other words, the number of stocks over the 200-day moving average, I think it's the highest since 1983, which is pretty amazing. But just that being said, some of that has to do with the fact that, you know, we saw that giant dip. So then, you know, the 200-day moving average had obviously moved down 6 months ago at its low point. So you saw that dramatic move down and a quick move down. So it wasn't like a smooth move and all of a sudden stocks just, you know, catapulting above it, I guess.
Well, a lot of the stocks, particularly the financial stocks, were so beaten down. And this rally has, some of them have doubled or tripled. Some
yeah.
of the Goldman has doubled since the lows in March.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to get a large movement to the upside. And that 200-day moving average is stable. We had a large, large drop in many stocks in the end of 2008. And so now the pullback is just reaching above that. The moving average as a slower, that's what it's supposed to do, to sort of smooth out the data for about 1 year's time. And with the S&P popping above, there's a great correlation with other stocks doing the same thing. So typically, that's a sign of a new bull market when you have that much thrust or impetus above these levels, or the percentage above. We like to think of it in terms of, well, because all these stocks are above, that must be a counterintuitive, or a
mm-hmm.
The market has to come down because so many stocks are above.
Mm-hmm.
Well, typically in a new market, you're going to have that thrust there, which catapults the market to higher prices. And so that's a different way to think of it somehow, but you're right. It's not typical to have this happen so quickly after such a down move.
Right. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, a lot of this stuff is not typical. I mean, low volume levels are not typical. Stocks moving the way they're moving are not typical. This is not stating that it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's the fact. It's just not a typical situation that we saw the big drawdown in October, then January through March. And it's not typical seeing this kind of move on the way up, or what stocks are doing for the various. I mean, stocks are moving in directions up and down, I think, that are very abnormal. Again, that's not good or bad. It's just abnormal.
Well, for me, I look at volume, and most technical analysis will say price and volume are the biggest indicators that exist.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing in this rally, typically it's a confirmation, non-confirmation, concept where price rallying, for the continuation of the rally, we would expect volume to be picking up.
Right.
So as prices go higher, more people are excited about it.
Right, more participation, buy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a depth of participation, depth of excitement, enthusiasm, and confidence.
Mm-hmm.
What we've seen across the board, Apple, I would recommend listeners go look at Apple's chart. Just do a standard price chart with volume overlaid with it, stockcharts.com, any kind of Yahoo Finance, Google Finance, Google, ExxonMobil. You just go down the list, and you'll see these rallies that are amazing rallies, but the volume is going down month after month, and that's what we would, as technical analysts, call a non-confirmation, and that would typically, under normal circumstances, precede a pullback or a reversal, that the prices that are higher are not being confirmed, but that's not happening. The normal rules of expectations are, I wouldn't say out the window, but it's puzzling to most technical analysts how this market continues to rise as volume falls across the board, it seems like.
Yeah, you'd wonder about that because, you know, two things. Maybe how about this for a theory, just thinking about this. How about that nobody's selling? Seriously, I know this sounds crazy, but, you know, people are not inclined to sell. But there's a little bit of buying coming in. Now, obviously, that sounds silly because if somebody's buying, somebody's selling. But what I'm saying is that, the sellers are backing away and they're willing to sell it higher, and they're not really willing to sell it lower. So what happens is that, you know, the buying is going to be pushing it. Does that make sense?
That's 100% correct. It's sort of more of an advanced concept, but it's almost a market profile or an auction theory type process. Prices will rise. Again, it's simple supply and demand. Well, to cause a price rise, either you have more people wanting to buy something than want to sell it, or you have sellers hanging on to it. And so really, price will auction higher to cause people to let go of their inventory. If Google jumped to $2,000, it's at $500 now, if it just automatically jumped to $2,000, you would have all those people that bought at lower levels just clamored over themselves to get out.
Right.
Because it's a windfall profit, the same thing. The supply-demand equation is affected. If sellers stay put, stay on their hands, the buyers will have to drive the prices higher to get them to relinquish it. And so in so doing, the price rises because that it's kind of a behind-the-scenes, a play on that, but that's really how it works. Supply and demand works that way. Of new buyers coming in actively or old sellers who have their merchandise hanging on to it, and they will only let go of it at higher prices.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, the price rise to for that to happen.
Right. So what? Let's go back to some technical analysis for one moment here. If there is no top end, what are you seeing for the S&P 500, the NASDAQ? Let's just leave it at those two for a moment. You know, what is your chart saying in terms of, what's happening and the confirmation? What is confirming?
Well, really, last time we spoke, we were looking at the April or so, and I had targeted the 1,000 level,
mm-hmm.
the S&P. It's kind of this is probably going to have most likely happen, but with the 1,100 or 1,100 to be sort of the ceiling of, that would be a large rally. And we're coming to that one. I know we're coming there. We're here right now.
Right.
And it's almost an arbitrary level. The market tends to respond a lot of times to round numbers. So the Dow peaked about 14,000. So just round numbers will be targets. We would call them magnets or open air to those levels. And so 1,100 on the S&P, Beyond that, we're going back to Fibonacci, but it's a retracement, taking the high of about 1576 down to the 666 low. The 50% retracement, or the halfway point, really is probably a better term than using Fibonacci. The halfway point of the entire bear market collapse is about 1,025 or 1,125 on the S&P. So that would be typical levels in that zone. Really, beyond that, we're not seeing a whole lot. Again, the price has risen so quickly that we've come above moving averages. And moving averages help tell us structure, but they also give us targets. So if price is under a moving average and it pulls up into it, 20-period, 50-period, 200, 100, whatever the period might be, that will be resistance. Well, we're above the 20 and the 50 on the weekly chart.
Mm-hmm.
Those are converging about the 1,000 level, I would say about 975 to be exact, and that would now become support expected. And the daily chart, let's see those on the S&P daily, we're well above those. Right, the 50 and the 20 are above 1,000, but we would call this the most bullish orientation possible on the daily chart, where price is above the short-term 20, intermediate 50, and longer-term 200-period moving averages.
Right, all three.
And they are all above each other. So that's as bullish as it gets, well, I guess, in terms of resistance. There is no resistance, not that I'm calling it necessarily a bull market, but there is no resistance in a bull market, and there is no support in a bear market. And that's kind of where we're rolling into in terms of moving averages.
So there's no support. I mean, there's no near support, is what you're saying.
There's no near-term
right.
resistance.
Right.
We're looking at the 50% retracement and the round number target at 1,100 or 1,100. Beyond that, there's really not much else to the upside. All the moving averages, which typically will form resistance, are beneath the price.
Right.
They can't form resistance when they're beneath, and so they would form support. The daily chart, we're seeing that price has been bouncing upwards off of these moving averages, and that's very bullish.
Well, I mean, there's no question that this has been a bullish market. I mean, you could basically say that a nuclear bomb went off somewhere and the market would go up these days.
It's almost. I feel that way sometimes.
When you said that a minute ago that, you know, you wouldn't call it a bull market, I know that you look at, I saw Robert Prechter's information a few days ago and was calling for an imminent collapse of the markets. Did you read that, by the way?
I did not read that one. I'm familiar with his views.
It was only a couple of days ago, I believe, that he called for an imminent collapse, an imminent move and a turn of this market to the downside. And we're not talking about, you know, a little bit of downside. We're talking about a lot. I mean, his views are pretty radical.
Right.
Even if, you know, you think that markets may move down by something, his views are very radical.
Give him credit, though. He did call. He was on CNBC and made the call. I think it was the S&P cracked above 800. He said, go ahead and cover your shorts. We're about to short positions. That is, if you're short selling the market, then we're going to have a rally. And he nailed this upside rally. And now you're right. He's coming into a bearish forecast at this point, at these levels here, at these resistance levels.
Right. It's interesting because you know, he just came out with that this week, and there was somebody else that came out with something as well. But you said you wouldn't call it a bull market. Why is that? I mean, a bull market traditionally is, any time, and you can call it a 20% move or a 30% move. Why, you mentioned it's not a bull market, or I think that's what
you
said.
We're transitioning into those things in terms of using historical or classical methods. A percentage, we call a bear market, one that goes down 20% from peak to trough.
So right.
That would be an automatic bear market.
Right.
Bull market could be that. There's no magical way to say this is a bull
right.
market.
Right.
It's not.
So, right.
You know, hindsight. But,
right.
but as we're transitioning, we're going to be looking at percentage moves, which 50% is,
that's bullish.
Is phenomenal.
Yeah, right.
It's bullish. but also the moving, right, exactly. But the moving average structures, price being above them, that's bullish.
Right.
Higher high. One thing that's interesting, higher highs, higher lows. So just the definition of an uptrend is one where the price will make a higher high,
right.
higher low,
mm-hmm.
higher high. And
mm-hmm.
we've actually, it's this move is almost, particularly on the monthly chart, on the S&P, NASDAQ, Dow monthly charts, it has been straight up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 7 months in a row. That's only a singular swing.
Mm-hmm.
On the weekly chart, it looks similar. So that's we need that higher low to confirm. And so the classic methods will always be late in calling an official trend. It's almost like the Bureau of Research.
Recession.
They will always be late. But there's a reason for that. It's not because it's silly or whatever. It's because we have to have the proof. We have to have the odds behind us and the objective scientific evidence before we can make that decision. As traders, we can front-run that, or as investors, but as an official classification, we have to use those sort of, I don't want to say antiquated, but those methods of objective classification. And it's we're in the transition phase, certainly, but I don't think we've actually done the official classification yet.
Right, I hear you.
We're probably close, very close, if not. If we go above 1,100, there's very few ways to argue a bear market from that point.
Yeah, and you know, I still get a lot of calls and a lot of people writing me and saying they don't understand. You know, and employment issues are high and economics are questionable. Corporate profits are, you know, coming up but still look not so good. Revenue is down. I mean, the whole gamut of discussions here. And, you know, we look at it and say the fact of the matter is that these days, you know, you have to ride the trend as best as possible but be cautious because things are moving around so rapidly, you know, on a daily basis. You see, you know, almost every day you see a 1% move. And, you know, who says that that can't be lined up in 1% moves from top to bottom up or from top to bottom down in a week? And, you know, by the time you're through with the week, you get a 5% down week. So, you know, the fact is that it's still a time to – it's always a time. It's always a time to, you know, be cautious and, as I say, disciplined and, you know, make sure to check all the channels, and not only including the fundamentals but the technicals, et cetera, and make sure that everything is lining up. You know, it's part science and part art, I guess, you know, all combined into one.
Exactly. Well, one thing quickly before we go is I did a recent study, and this is around the blogosphere world and the analytical world, looking backwards. So if we look at it, it's how we do classical analysis. Take what we see now, put it in context of history. I did a post recently that the market now from 2008 is up 52% in 28 weeks off the March bottom. Looking backwards to 1938, we went up 60, which is 37 crash. The Dow was at 200. It's so strange to think in those terms, but the Dow Jones was at 200 at that time. And the 37 crash, after that happened, we rose 62% in 31 weeks. And then we began to collapse to new lows after that. And the actual bottom was not made, I think, until about 1942. So we made new lows after that. And, of course, people are looking in terms of the recession, depression, fundamental quant analysts are saying we're comparing to the 1929 rally. At that point in time, after that crash, we rallied 53% in 22 weeks. So we are. That's the reason I'm not calling it a bull market just yet, because these prior, almost like the spike to the downside, it was so
abrupt.
Devastating.
Right.
And so a 50% rally. You know, we're not really, it's not that impressive when you say just off the bottom. Going from $1 to $2 is 100%.
Right.
Going from 99 to 100 is a percent, or less. And percentage-wise, looking at that. But that's the reason I'm not jumping up and down and calling a bull market, because we're still in those parameters of prior market crash cycles. And until we break that or have a general swing low, form that lower, higher low, and then take out a higher high, that would get me more confident. But we're still, until proven otherwise, in these crash parameters.
Right. I hear you. All right. Corey Rosenblum, AfraidToTrade.com. I encourage you to go check him out. He has all sorts of analysis on a daily basis and kind of does a good job. But what I like what you do is you go and you look at the day and how the day was, and you kind of look at it and rip it apart and put it back. And, you know, do a lot of teaching on your site. So I think that's really great, and you're a great teacher. And I appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, we'll talk soon, Corey. Be well. Bye-bye. Well, thanks for joining me today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you real soon. Next week, we have an expert on the banking area. He's a former credit analyst, and for some of the big firms, he's going to let us in on the inside of what's going on in the worldwide banking and some of the new rules that have cropped up and some things that you need to take a look at. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. Make sure to tell a friend about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I really appreciate that. If you like what you hear here, tell somebody. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.